My name's Johnny Morgan and Kit Alexander. This is the Filthy Lip Out Podcast in association with Motocaddy, the world's biggest selling trolley brand. How about that? How can I introduce him? He's a US Open champion. It's Michael Campbell.
Hey! It's a lovely trophy.
I've got a little friend here.
That is a beauty.
Yep.
Mate, how much do you want for it?
Yeah.
It's how much do you want for it?
£5.
Yeah?
That's a bargain. We'll timeshare it. Sorted.
Mate, how good is
now,
that?
I'll tell you what, guys. This trophy is 90% of the size itself of the original one. And it's quite a funny story. In 1922, let me see, who won in 1922? Gene Sarazen. Yeah, Gene Sarazen won it, right?
Oh, 1922. Oh, my God.
And if you look at all the trophies before then, it was different. The reason why, because Gene Sarazen lent it to his local club where he grew up playing golf, and it got burnt down.
Oh,
so they mounted the trophy. So they collected the trophy, the melted metal, and made this one. Not this one here, obviously, but the one from 1923 onwards. It's the same trophy since then. So if you look at all the pictures, it's a different trophy. So there you go.
That's a bit of a US history
for you, yeah.
I love that.
Oh, man.
History lesson to begin. I love it.
Oh, mate, get to see the US Open.
Yeah.
That is unbelievable.
Thanks so much for coming on. I mean, the US Open, let's talk about that. There's nowhere else to start. You've shown us the trophy. Looking back on that, how proud are you to be a major champion? You're the first major champion, actually, we've ever had on the Filthy Lip Out podcast. We've had some amazing people, but you are the first major champion.
Blessed.
John's got the mug, the US Open mug. What's it like to say you're a major champion? How cool is that?
Yeah, I suppose it's pretty cool. obviously that year for me was a pretty incredible year, with not only the winning the US Open, but also winning the World Match Play in the same year. And I joined a pretty elite group that time, because there's only been four guys who've won the US Open and the World Match Play the same year. And it was Gary Player, Nicholas, Ernie Els, and myself. So that was a pretty cool club to be a
decent little list.
Elito.
Yeah, but obviously, you know, winning the US Open 2005 and during Tiger's peak, you know, if you think about it, he was just flying, wasn't he, for those probably 7-8 years where he won pretty much everything. And to win, obviously, my major under the circumstances, like he was, I think, two shots behind with 9 holes to play. And to beat him, because he won Augusta, you know, 2 months before, and he won the Open 2 months later. So he was just flying, and to stop him was it makes it even more special.
Were you aware when his name was on the leaderboard there? Everyone talks about, oh, once Tiger gets on the leaderboard, it feels different. What was it like for you in that situation?
Well, you know, I'm a firm believer that the words you speak and the feelings you have, it's the future, basically. So I said to myself, okay, just look at this situation right now, this scenario that, yes, Tiger's right there. He's two shots behind me. But just enjoy the moment. Just enjoy the seeing this opportunity, not a threat. You know, it's a fight or flight. So that's been the whole psychology really kicked in for me, I think. And all the previous times I've been in contention, not at a major, obviously, but just winning tournaments before then, I collected all these mental tools from my toolbox, and I used every single one of them, I think, in the last 9 holes, because I actually needed to. It was tough mentally. I knew I was playing well enough, obviously, to get in this situation initially, but I knew that the last 9 holes were going to be mentally tough, and I managed to beat him by a couple of shots, I think.
I mean, when I was out on tour, Michael, I was out on the US tour 03, 04, and 05. So my last year was the year you won the US Open. And every time I met up with Tiger and I see him on a putting green or anything, it just, the aura, the starstruckness I always had around him. Did you feel, I mean, you had to put that to the side, obviously, but were you still feeling the aura and the starstruckness of Tiger Woods being the player that he is?
It probably sounds very cocky, but no, because...
No, that's not cocky. That's good.
Because I've had a lot with Tiger during that time, you know, because I was playing well, I was in tournaments around the world, and I was paired with him, and I got to know him quite personally and as a friend. So I saw him as just another golfer. I know it's hard to fathom that in a lot of people's minds, but if you are in awe of someone and you put them on the pedestal, how are you going to beat them? It's one of those things you've got to overcome mentally, I think. And there's one thing I did, actually, which is quite funny, I want to share with you guys, is because he played in front of me, right, and the crowd was just phenomenal. There's like 50,000 people watching him and about 1,000 watching me. It's just all about Tiger. So every time there's a big roar, you know, I would he hit a good shot or hole, because I think he had like 4 birdies the last 9 holes, or 3, I can't remember exactly, but whatever it was. But every time the crowd reacted to his shot, was putt, you know, I was dobbing my hat and did it again, another roar, dobbing my hat. And my caddy said to me, "What the hell are you doing, Cambo?" I said, "Well, I'm deflecting all the energy from Tiger to me." So I was absorbing all that positivity and all that, you know, adulation from the crowds. Yeah. Deflecting off Tiger and giving it to me. I mean, and the thing is, you got to realize that no psychologist taught me that. It just came from the golfing gods. So that's a pretty cool thing.
Was that the first time you'd done something like that? Did it just come to the moment there?
First time. No, I have no idea where it came from. It just, I don't know. It's hard to explain. I think it's one of those things where the Maori people, I'm a Maori, obviously from New Zealand, are very spiritual, and we believe that there's spiritual guides look after you after they pass away. And yeah, I just felt someone spoke to me about it and said, "Michael, you got to do this, and it will help you," and it definitely helped me. So it was a pretty cool thing.
I'm trying to put myself in that position, Michael. That's amazing. Like trying to take off from what you're hearing. I mean, I only got down the stretch a few times, like hearing a few roars and chasing it or leading or something like that. But to deflect it that way and bring it back to you and feel like it's all about you and they're cheering you on, that's a huge psychological boost, massive boost. I mean, I'm trying to get that around my brain at the moment. I can't get that around my brain. That's a good one though, mate. I'm gonna try and start using that.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, as I said before, guys, it just came to me. I mean, I've no explanation how or why, but it just came to me in a natural way. And I never used it before until that day. And yeah, so it definitely helped me towards the end.
How much did life change as a major champion? Did it just overnight click? It's different. I'm a major champion. I'm getting treated differently. Or were you able to take it in your stride? Because we see with some players, they take a while to get used to it afterwards and then refine the form that got them there.
It definitely shakes your world. I mean, that's one thing that I want to say is that no one prepares you for it. No one prepares for the fishbowl kind of feeling. It's just incredible. It's wonderful to have, you know, because the reason why I play golf is to win trophies, nothing else. I don't need the fame and fortune. But obviously it's part of the package and you got to learn from it and you got to, you know, do certain things in your life or adjust your life to being a major winner. I mean, the first year or so was completely chaotic. That's more I can say. It's all the commitments you have. And, you know, I was doing a lot of charity work, a lot of corporate days. I was playing less golf, unfortunately. I was doing other things. Which I really enjoy. I take full responsibility for it, absolutely, in my actions. But yeah, it was tough. It was very, very tough in a good way. It's tough, but just managing your time. Yeah. It was one time I'll never forget. And this is from a father talking here, is that my son at the time was 7 years old when I won the US Open. He's born in 98. So yeah, 7 years old. And he loves playing chess, and I'll teach him how to play chess before the US Open. Right. And then I win it, come back home. And I'll never forget where he was. He didn't understand what happened. He's got no idea, right? So we're sitting there, and he goes, "Daddy, can I play chess with you?" I said, "Absolutely." So I remember sitting down in the morning with him and setting up the chess pieces and ready to go and teaching him how to, you know, the first moves and what each piece does sort of thing. And I was, the phone never stopped ringing. It was like 2 days after I got back, and he sat there for 2 hours waiting for me. and that's when I realized that my world has definitely changed. And I felt sorry for him, you know, because he didn't really care about what happened, what I did. Yeah. You know, when he won the biggest tournaments in the world and been the best player in the world, he didn't care about that. He just wanted to know how to play chess. So it really put things in perspective, and it kind of taught me that, you know, life is more important. Yes, it's nice to win majors and that sort of stuff, but life is much more important than, you know, than golf. Golf is only a sport that we play.
Absolutely.
And how much has it changed now? I mean, we had the... You won the US Open. I mean, if I know I'm gonna put something out there that's more a bit more like what we're seeing nowadays. What would a power game like Bryson DeChambeau do around a golf course that you won on back then in 05, buddy? What would happen there?
Well, you know, I mean, a perfect example there is when he won at Wingfoot. I played Wingfoot 2006 when I was defending, and it was that's tough, right. Rough, and it was a huge advantage. Like, he'll tear it apart. I mean, it's not a long golf course, Pinehurst number two. But he would just, the clubs he's hitting, even, you know, this week at Augusta, it's just ridiculous. Do I like it? No, because I'm a bit of an old school. You know, I really admire
what he's done in the game. Yeah.
It's taken away the artistry, I think, of golf a little bit. Now it's just a power game, as you know, John. You know, you've been out there now commenting on course, and these kids now hit it so far. I mean, I get a good one. I'm flying at 280 to 300. These kids are flying at 320, you know, 300, 310 to whatever, to 350. So they've got, you know, 3-4 club advantage. So, you know, some of the clubs he was hitting into Wingfoot, Bryson, you know, like a driver 9-9 on a par 5, you know, at a major, that's just ridiculous.
It is ridiculous, man. It is ridiculous.
So, you know, it's a combination of a lot of things. You know, obviously the manufacturers have got the ball wolf going further and all that sort of stuff. Technology's changed. The way that now, that, you know, TrackMan and Swing Catalyst, and you've got the gear system, you've got the K-Vest, and it tells you every single figure you can even think about in golf. So it's called evolution. You know, the game has evolved, and you look at all the different sports around the world. You've got rugby, you've got rugby league, you've got, you know, cricket, for example, the runners, for example, the athletics, they're bigger, stronger, and faster. And this is what, it's another phase of golf that we're going through. Like, when Norman was around, he was the first guy, and Gary played before him, and then Tiger came along, he started this whole fitness thing. Now, Bryson's starting another generation of young kids now. I was there today, actually, at my golf academy here in southern Spain, and I was teaching these young kids. And before the whole evolution of hitting it further, I used to teach them technique first, then, you know, and find the fairway kind of thing. But now it's just hit as hard as you can first, and we'll just straighten up later on. That's one thing that's changed a lot, I think, in coaching. And also, you know, I've been out there playing on the European Tour, as you know, I've seen you out there too, John. And, you know, it's different. Because I was away for 6 years, don't forget, 7 years not playing.
Yeah, long time, man, long time.
Yeah. Yeah, take a little sabbatical there and came back and thought, wow, this is completely different. It's just phenomenal.
Because when I picture, I obviously got hold of you in Cyprus the other week, and it was, you know, we were looking down at 18, weren't we? We were on the putting green at the time, looking down 18, seeing these shots come in and seeing them obviously able to take it over that bunker, which was 290 carry off the tee, and which was a lovely place, wasn't it, Aphrodite Hills, by the way, wasn't it? It was gorgeous.
Fantastic.
But, mate, that's a golf course, right? That I just thought, you got this thing about bifurcations and all this malarkey about technology and stuff. That looked like a golf course. It was adapted to the power game. Like, you couldn't really take it on and overpower that golf course. The only hole you could do it was 18, because you had a 290 carry where the likes of me and you, Double D, you know, a couple of us would have struggled to... We'd have to hit our Sunday best to get over it. You know what I mean? And that... What did you think of that style of golf course, boss?
Well, the thing is that if you look at all the guys who are in contention, Double D, you mentioned before, and so Jamie Dollison, they're not long hitters, right? And that's why they're in contention, because the most is a lot of par, short par fours. I think it was under 7,000 yards.
Yeah, it was 6,008 something. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's still a challenging golf course. And if you have an extra gear with your driver, and 18 is a perfect example, this guy's hitting driver 8-iron in there. You know, I couldn't reach, you know, because I couldn't carry it, you know, 290, 300 over those bunkers. So, you know, it's a huge advantage. And it's the same with Bryson hitting, you know, all these short clubs into these long par fours and par fives. But you got to realize, you know, a 2-foot putt is just as important as a 350-yard par drive off a tee. So that's the thing that people don't really understand, because they're just so overawed about how far these guys are hitting it now. But you got to understand also these factors in the round of golf that matters as well.
How nice has it been to play, though, in these tournaments, Michael? These two that you played in Cyprus, and you played like over in Wales and a couple of other ones, you know, have you really enjoyed it?
Yeah, I've really enjoyed just competing again. You know, I'm just warming up really for the seniors tour next year. So that's the reason why I wanted to come over and play on the European tour and play a few events, just to get the, you know, juices going, you could say, the competitiveness going and stuff like that. So, you know, my expectations for those events weren't, you know, that great. I just wanted to keep on playing. I know I can compete very well on the seniors tour, both here and also on the champions tour. So that was my goal, really. My goal, my aim was just to keep on playing. And, you know, because, you know, I'm hitting 7-irons to par fours. These guys are hitting 9-irons or even wedge to a par four. So that's the big difference there.
Yeah. How are you feeling physically? Because obviously you've had the issues in the past. And like you say, you took that sabbatical. Part of that was a physical need to step away from the game for a little bit. How are you at the moment feeling in yourself physically?
Yeah, I'm pretty good, actually. I must say I'm 51. You know, I actually move pretty much the same. I haven't gained any speed, but that will come hopefully with a bit more training for next year. That's one thing I want to do. I've got 2 months until I start on the seniors tour next year, so I'm going to get back into the gym. But I mean, my fighting weight, I call it, is 92 Ks. I'm still 92 Ks. Mm-hmm. I was 92 Ks when I won the US Open. So I'm pretty much physically, weight-wise, pretty much the same. Maybe not as strong as I used to be, obviously, you know, 15 years ago when I won it. So, but besides that, yeah, it's all good to go.
Yeah. I mean, there was one other thing in the US Open I wanted to talk about, and that's you went through the qualifier at Walton Heath and you had to hole a 6-foot birdie putt on the last just to get into that sort of last spot and get through and qualify.
It was 30 feet. It was 30 feet.
30 feet.
It was 30 feet.
The stories have done a disservice. It's grown over the years. A good birdie putt you had to hold.
Every year it gets longer.
Foot each year. That's what my stories do.
It's quite a funny story once again, guys, is that I want to rewind to the start of the year in 2005. I played some horrible golf. Horrible golf. And I missed like 6 cuts in a row. And I went to the Dubai Swing, Malaysia, and I played shooting 80s. And it was embarrassing. So I flew to America for 5 weeks and I worked my butt off. Worked my ass off. And I found what I call a golden nugget. Is that gin in there, by the way?
Probably.
Of course it is, mate. Of course it is. Right, we're in Spain, aren't we? Well, I'm pretending I am anyway.
No, and so I found this what I call a golden nugget, right, with my coach Jonathan Yarwood, who I was working with in Orlando. So I came back to the European Tour in May, and I finished top 10 and top 5, and all of a sudden I was playing well. Momentum was nice. The confidence was growing. And then I played 5 weeks in a row, playing some great golf. And I wasn't going to go actually to the qualifying, but because it's only like a 45-minute drive from my house, I used to live in Brighton.
Yeah,
my wife at the time said to me, "Just go." So I went. I was first off at 7:30 in the morning with Webby, Steve Webster, right?
Oh, nice.
Yeah, both shoot 3-under, I think, or 2-under, maybe 3-under the first round, and the scoreboards all along, so we know 4-1 is going to make it. So we're both 3-under playing the last hole. Webby hits to 10 feet. I hit to 9 feet.
30 feet, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. 30 feet. And I managed to get it because I had to move my marker because I was right on his line. So I moved my marker. And as you do, when Webby hit it, I kind of like a little glimpse.
Have a little look.
Yeah, a little look, and yeah, fair enough. It was, I thought it was right edge before you hit it, and it stayed right edge and stayed there. So you missed it, and I aimed inside right and hold it. So there you go. I was the last person to qualify.
Amazing. What was going through your mind? Can you remember what was going through your mind as you were stood over that birdie putt to get in?
Just to hold it.
Yeah.
Just to hold it.
Yeah, I think as you know, John, you know, if you've played on tour, it's all about just going through your processes and executing that shot at the time. You don't think about consequences. You don't think about, you know, what's going to happen if you miss it. Well, you know, it's the last thing I want to think about. Just go through your processes, go through your routine and just try and hold it.
Well, I think that particularly that year when I had a go at US Open qualifying, and I remember Rosie Donald qualified, we were at Congressional, and you know, we were trying to qualify right now, and I had to go into a 5-man playoff with, you know, multiple winners on the PGA Tour, but we just went into it. And I remember having a 5-footer on the first extra hole, snaky one left to right. I missed it. And it was one spot, and I had the putt, and I didn't get in the open, or that trophy would have been mine, Michael. I'd have taken it off your hands, mate.
Thank you that you missed that putt.
I'm all give, mate. I'm all give.
Otherwise, you'd be holding this instead of me.
Exactly. Oh, mate. God. What would I do to give, eh?
Did you speak to Steve Webster after you actually won, knowing now that you literally changed the read on that putt that got you there based on seeing him hit it? Have you spoken?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We speak about it all the time. We see each other. We actually laugh about it. But, yeah, it's quite phenomenal, really, how that kind of, you know, that came about. It's just fate. I don't know what you want to call it. It was meant to be.
Things I think are just meant to be, aren't they?
Yeah. Amazing. Mate, the vibe back home in New Zealand. Tell me all about it, because I've got a lot of friends in New Zealand. Reese and Jamie, lovely couple that live over there and do the top tracer and help with all the graphics that you see at the Masters.
Yeah, that's
all the
right,
graphics all over the world. I mean, they're massive fans of you. It's a big shout out to them. I know they're going to be listening to this because to Reese, you're his idol. You know, he loves you to bits, boss. And I mean, tell us about the fan base over back home, man. And did you get a lovely tattoo after your win? You must have got a tattoo.
No, I didn't get a tattoo. No way. you know, what Reese and Jamie has done for the game of golf itself is fantastic. The technology now is used all around the world, which is great for New Zealand company to do that. But the response from back home was obviously pretty phenomenal. You got to realize it's a very small country. It's 5 million people there, and people focus on the All Blacks, and that's it. I mean, any other sport is like a secondary kind of thing, which is natural. I mean, when I was growing up in New Zealand, my first goal was to be an All Black, absolutely, hands down, an All Black. But I realized after about 10 years, I wasn't big enough, strong enough, fast enough. So I thought I'd give golf a crack. But
I can see you a bit like a Danny Carter. I can see you have a bit of a kick in Houdini. I can see it, man. I can see it.
No, I used to pass. I used to be a halfback. I'm not sure what you call it.
Scrum half. No,
Scrum half. Yeah. I was pretty good at that, passing both ways. I had a pretty good box kick too. So. Anyway,
is there like rugby tour? Can you get involved in that? Is there?
But the thing I loved about that week is how they embraced my win. I mean, I was taken back by it. It was an incredible time. I'll never forget the time when I said to my managers at the time, IMG, I said, I want to go back home for 10 days. I want to go back home. And they said to me, are you crazy? You want to go back home? Because it's 2 months after, no, a month after I won.
Yeah,
I had 2 weeks off or 3 weeks off. I said, I want to go back home and share my success with my people. I mean, make it happen. And they made it happen. And I'll tell you what, it was crazy. Mm-hmm. Absolutely just crazy.
I mean, it gives me goosebumps just thinking about it, Michael. It gives me goosebumps, yeah, bud. Awesome.
Yeah, they had a ticky tape parade. Oh, 120,000 people turned up, and I was talking to the organizer. He's been around there for a long time. He said that on the ticket sale parade, he said that the biggest one they had was the Beatles, and yours was the second biggest. So that was pretty cool.
Oh, so
that is so good.
That's yeah. I wanted to ask you a bit about your Maori heritage, because you mentioned it slightly earlier, and it's fascinating, you know, for people outside New Zealand, you know, you see the All Blacks doing the haka and all of these kind of things. And for us, it's such an emotive thing. And you mentioned the spirituality a little bit earlier. How much has that shaped you as a golfer and a person, that you're from that background? And frankly, not many professional golfers have come from that background and with that Maori influence.
Okay, I want to start by going back to when I was growing up in New Zealand. You got to realise, you know, a very humble beginnings. I mean, to think outside the box is unusual. It's all about being together.
Yeah.
Being a tribe. A tribe is, and they'll always protect you. And if you think outside the box, it's, you're all by yourself, sort of thing. There was a time where, you know, and my mum and dad had worked both two jobs basically to keep us above board, and we had council housing. I'm not sure what you call it in England. You know, we couldn't afford electricity, so we had to use you know, candles at night time and hot water bottles for electric blanket. You know, things like that. You know, so
same here, buddy. Same here. Know where you're coming from, bud.
Yeah, exactly, John. So, and then you know, where I started playing golf was at a very, it was a farm. It is a farm. It was 9-hole golf course and had fences around the greens to keep the sheep out.
Yeah.
And all I had was a cut down 6-iron, and I couldn't afford tees, so I had to use dried up sheep shit.
That's brilliant.
Love it.
I thought you were going to go with sand. Didn't see the dried up sheep shit coming. I'll be honest. I love it.
Yeah. So that was my beginning, right? And so it was very humble beginnings, you could say. So that's why, you know, when I said before about the game of golf itself, it's only a game because, yes, it's catapulted me into, you know, into a major winner and all that sort of stuff. It's very important, but I think that's why I really, you know, when I do win, I think that's it's kind of special. So, but the culture itself is something that I always draw upon, as you said before. It's given me strength over time. I'm not sure if you saw, but when I hold that putt on 18, I look towards the heavens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I thank my what we call tupuna. Tupuna means the people who passed on before you, mm-hmm. For their strength, because I was drawing upon their strength to get me through the last 9 holes. Trust me, I was looking above all the time, going, "Come on, guys, give me a hand here, give me a hand." And that's when that thought about, you know, dobbing my hat came. So maybe it was them talking to me. You know, obviously, everyone's different with religion, you know, but, you know, we are very religious in this very different way, very spiritual people. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the same with the haka. And every time I see, even today, every time I see the haka on TV before they start playing rugby or any other sport, I get goosebumps. It's basically the haka means that they're challenging the opponents to do for battle. And if you translate it, it doesn't really make sense, but if you translate it from Maori to English, it's basically saying, we're going to just kick your butt.
You're going down, man. You're in our territory. Yeah. That is it. Well, mate, it's amazing. You know, New Zealand, it's a place I've yet to go, and I can't wait to go. Reese actually gave me that as a friend, you know, and I've known it ever since.
Very nice.
So I'm really happy. My cousin ended up getting me the old what's the one with the face, the little miniature one.
Tiki.
Yeah. So I got two, mate. I feel very blessed, and I've been given them. So you can't buy it for yourself, by all accounts. That's the truth, isn't it?
So. Always has to be a gift. Because I was wearing Panamus or necklaces for a very long time. Once again, it brings you the closeness of who you are. That's one thing I actually did back in the mid 90s is I wanted to see where I came from. So I did a family tree and traced the Campbells. And that was a really cool thing to see that my great, 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 great grandfather, Slogan Campbell, came over from Edinburgh back in 1845. and who was the Auckland, the mayor of Auckland.
Wow.
And he had many wives back in those days, as you can imagine.
Yes, you did.
To get away with.
Yeah. But how's this though? How's this? It's just a very powerful thing for me. And it really cemented my reasoning and the reason why I'm on this planet and how it all happened. Yeah. Is I found Sir Logan Campbell's house and they drive 2 hours north or 3 hours north of Loch Lomond. I can't remember the name of it, but I found his house where he was born. Wow. So I remember knocking on the door of this house, right? I don't know how I found it, but I found it. And this big burly Scotchman answers the phone, the door, and goes, "Oh, where are you?
Are you?"
And I said, "Oh, my name's Michael Campbell. I want to, you know." So I told him about Sir Logan Campbell, and he goes, "Oh, follow me." So he invited me into his house very kindly, and he brought me downstairs in the basement of his house, big house, and he showed me all these artifacts from New Zealand that he brought home. You know, all these bone carvings and stuff like that, and it was just it was incredible. Yeah, it was such a cool thing. It's such a cool journey.
That is amazing. Great story, Michael.
I wanted to ask you also, Michael, obviously you've had the immense highs, but then you've had lows in your career as well, and we know the injuries were frustrating, and then the loss of form at the back end prior to retirement. What was that like for you to go through, having been to the very pinnacle of the game?
Well, the thing is that, you know, my golf game always came in cycles. Every 5 years, I continue to do well.
I'm the same.
For you?
Oh, what, exactly 5 years? The same, mate. Came in cycles. 1 minute, hot to trot. No one's going to beat me. Next minute, it's like, can't find me out. Don't know what I'm doing.
When are you due a good one?
Well, the thing is that, you know, if you ask all my friends, ever since I was an amateur, I was always hot and cold. You know, I'm either shooting 65s or 85s. Why? I have no idea. Yes, it's very frustrating, but it's always there. It's always there somewhere inside me. Yeah. And it was my job to find it again. As you know, form is temporary and a class is permanent. So, you know, it's always there somehow. You always know how to play golf.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
exactly. But for me, it was more like, how can I say this? you got to understand that I don't like attention. I don't like, you know,
the spotlight.
The spotlight, people looking at me. I know that's kind of strange, but I grew up playing golf, not thinking about the stardom of it, you know, the fame of it. All I wanted to do to do this.
Prove it to yourself. Just prove it to yourself.
And then obviously, you know, as I said before, it's a byproduct, the whole money and the fortune and the fame. And I didn't like it. So maybe subconsciously, I said to myself, okay, Mark, if you play bad for a couple of months or maybe a year, it'll go away. And sure, they did, you know. And then all of a sudden you go, oh, and your ego kicks in and goes, oh, God, I missed that. So... I start playing well again. It's just one of those things I always did.
Yeah. Where do you feel your game is right now? As you say earlier, you're going into the Champions Tour, the Legends Tour over in Europe next year, and you feel good about it. You feel you're in one of those five-year cycles where you're going to go in there and tear it up.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that, you know, my goal this year was just to keep on playing and figure things out a little bit. You know, I don't hit it far. And I mean, if you compare it to 10 years ago, I was like, hey, but now I'm so far behind, I can't catch up because I haven't got time to, you know, go to the gym like I used to when I was active, you know, when I used to go to gym 3 hours, 4 hours a day. Mm-hmm. My train every day. I haven't got time for that. I've done that.
Yeah.
I've took that box. It's time to move on. And I want to just have fun. You know, it's not very... games or sport that has a second, you can start another chapter in your life, and this is definitely one of those chapters right now for me, is to go out there and play again.
Okay, it's competition time again, folks. It is the third and final keyword today to win one of those three Motocaddy Hydroflex stand bags worth £209.99. It's an award-winning bag. It's waterproof, super light, extremely versatile, designed to fit onto any motor caddy trolley, thanks to the pioneering Easy Lock compatibility. totally flexible, have it on the trolley, carry it if there's a trolley ban over winter. It's got full length dividers, five big pockets, everything you want, John. Perfect, isn't it? I know you've got one.
Yeah, absolutely perfect. Nice. Plenty of room for a few tinnies in there if you're going around the golf course with your mates, putting it on your buggy, you know, plenty of golf ball storage, waterproofs, you name it, it's got it. Like you said, it's waterproof in, you know, for where I live as well. That's essential.
Cracking. Oh, it never rains in Britain, John. Never rains. Okay, never. What's the third code word?
Nuts.
Nuts. N-U-T-S. Add those to the two code words you got in the previous two episodes. If you don't have them, go back and listen now and find them. Send those three code words to filthylipout@hotmail.com. And three of you lucky listeners who send us the correct words will be winning a Motor Caddy Hydroflex golf bag.
You're down in Spain now. Can you tell us a bit about this, mate? You're in all the lovely sunny weather. What are you doing down there and where are you based?
Well, basically, I lived in Brighton for such a long time, 15, 16 years or whatever, and I was sick of the weather, basically. I love London. Don't get me wrong. It was a good base for me when I was playing. I flew from Gatwick or Heathrow for most of the time, Gatwick, so it was very convenient. And, I don't know, what's it, 8 years ago, I said to my wife at the time, I said, we need to move because I've had enough of the winters. So we came around here on holiday and we had a few friends here. We found this nice little place here. And ever since then, I've been here for the last 8 years. I've managed to start my golf academy here down in southern Spain at Villa Pediana, which is near Marbella.
Yeah.
It's half an hour from Sola Grande, from Valderrama, so not far from those places. And the thing is that what I've really enjoyed, because I stopped playing for those, you know, 8 years or so, or 7 years, is that it was time for me to get back to the game that's given me so much. And the way to do that is the platform or vehicle was definitely, a golf academy. And I've really enjoyed just sharing my experiences from a player's point of view, but also coaching as well, technically.
Definitely.
And knowledge to these kids. But I'll tell you a story behind that, the reason why it all started. was in 2005. So 2005, won the US Open, and I won the World Match Play. And very next day, so I just won the World Match Play on Sunday. I think it was around, I can't remember, October or something, or whatever it was. And we flew to Washington, D.C. for the President's Cup. So I'm the favorite of the month, you know, you could say.
Of course,
went to the White House, to the White House and all that other stuff. I don't care for, but you know, it's just one of those things that's all part of the whole package. So it was the function, black tie function, and my captain at the time was Gary Player, and on American captain was Jack Nicklaus. So it's a Tuesday now. So here we are at this black tie function. And I see Jack Nicklaus, you know, come over to me, and he was very complimentary about my win, watching every shot, beating Tiger. He was fantastic, and you know, world match play. It was just an incredible conversation with this one of the greatest players in the world that ever lived, ever played the game. And all of a sudden, I'll never forget this. All of a sudden, his face just changed, like got a steely look, like he.
Ooh.
He does on the golf. I think, oh my goodness, what have I done here? And he said to Michael, he's pointing the finger at me like, Michael, now that you're a major winner, you have a responsibility to grow this game. And he walks off. So I'm standing there thinking, holy crap.
God.
Yeah. What does that mean? And now I kind of realize what it means is that, you know, now I had the opportunity to pass on my knowledge through a golf academy. So he planted that seed all those years ago, and it grew now, and it grew, and here we are. So that's the story behind it.
How cool is it to feel like you can really shape things over there in southern Spain? Like you say, a lot of juniors that you're working with as well. And also, do they realise they're getting coached by a major champion?
Well, it's before their time, because most of them are still nappies then, but you know. But these teenagers, they Google everything, YouTube everything. So they kind of know what's happening, but or what I did as a player. And that solidifies really that they trust me. Because if you think about it, they're putting their career in my hands, and to have the qualifications, you could say, player's point of view, I think that kind of helps.
You know, when you get, you know, when you find a young pupil, Michael, and you know that'll come to you now, do you find there's a difference? I mean, there was that the pupil want to go that extra mile. They're not going to leave until you tell them they're okay to leave. Like, meaning they want to stay there until they've got it, you know, and they can't take no for an answer.
No. No. I call them. They want instant gratification.
Yeah.
And this is where I had this conversation with many people about instant gratification. They want it now. They think if they work for a couple of hours on the range, that's good enough. I'm sorry, it's not good enough. I mean, telling these kids over and over again. And it all comes down to social media, if you think about it.
Yeah.
Social media, I mean, they post something and they see who likes it or who, you know, shared it, sort of thing. It's that kind of generation right now, is they want it now, but it's not going to happen now. And also they're getting to the numbers too much, you know, because obviously you've got a TrackMan. And the first thing I look at is, yes, it's a great device to help you scientifically. Yeah. Absolutely. It doesn't lie. You get instant feedback, right? So they expect instant results. And that's the thing. I see a lot of kids fall into that trap of they think they got it within an hour, but no, you get to work the whole day. When I was, you know, their age, 16, 18, 20 years old, whatever, I was on the golf. I was practicing, as you know, like you, John. I was out there for 10 hours a day.
Hands bleeding. Look at the calluses still remaining from many moons ago. I mean,
what from? What from? From?
Oh, farming.
No, what's the calluses from though?
I can't tell you. It's very sore wherever it is. Anyway,
Can you show to the camera then, John? Is that
that is should my calluses on my hand? You donut. Yeah. So what is it? But like you say, man, I never stopped until my hands were bleeding. And you know, once my coach, you probably remember him, George Rahl, used to have the best moustache and long hair. But he was my coach, and when he laid down the gauntlet, you know, says, I don't know if you can get there. It's like, I will get there. Don't you bloody worry about it. You know, all of a sudden, just the sportsman inside me just, you know, wouldn't back down and had to have it. And I'd stay there for hours on end if it needed. And I wasn't a massive practicer. I wanted to be on the golf course or on the chipping green hitting crazy shots and getting really inventive and stick balls behind trees and try and bend it as hard as I can around them and get it on the green. And yeah, I just don't see that nowadays in the kids.
But also, too, one thing I've noticed is that the parents push them. They, you know, the parents want to live their dream through their children. I see that a lot here now. As soon as I see that, I know they're going to fail.
Yeah.
Pure and simple. It has to come, as you said, John, it has to come within. It's got to come from here. Not from other people pushing you, because, you know, you are your you are the person who wants to create your own, you know, future by doing it yourself through hard work. Hard work ethic, you know. I mean, I remember saying to the kids what I used to do when I was active or playing or practicing. It's 12-hour days, not just an hour on the track, man. That's it. They're actually quite lazy. To be honest,
massively.
Not everyone. Thank you.
Not everyone.
But most of them.
It's a generational thing. Like you say, we live in a world with social media, of instant gratification, of wanting everything now, immediately. Television's on demand. It's not, I've got to wait a week to watch an episode of this. It's, I can watch the whole thing right now. Boom. Everything in society these days is built around instant gratification and getting what you want, when you want it, how you want it now. Golf is the antithesis of that, isn't it?
That's a song, isn't it? Is that a song?
It takes hard work. It takes time. And I think that's why golf is so great in modern society, because it brings you back to those cores of that self-determination, that the more you put in, the more you will get out, that it takes time, that things aren't always fair, or in golf's case, are never fair. You know, life, it's a lesson for life in many ways. And I think a lot of people growing up now in the younger generations lose sight of that because of simply the environment and the world they grow up in as what we have it now.
That's a very good point. Very good point. I mean, the thing is that it teaches you, as you said before, it teaches you life skills, isn't it? Because it's a game that's hard to play. If you don't practice or appreciate it, it'll just grab you by the balls and just start twisting, because you need that. You need their dedication, their work ethic, their attitude, the desire to succeed, all those important things. And, you know, most of these kids, not all of them, I said before, not all of them, but most of them think they can do it. You know, that if that person can do it, I can do it without practicing. But no, it's not going to happen that way.
Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Absolutely. Michael, it's been a pleasure to chat, the US Open chat. That little bit there as well, I found so interesting as well about the young kids these days. Great stuff that you're doing over there in Spain. Thank you so much for taking the time to come.
Pleasure.
I say, first ever major champion on the podcast.
Thanks, Michael. Legend, man.
Pleasure. All right, guys.
Hope everyone at home, you enjoyed listening to that as much as we did. We've been Filthy Lip Out in association with Motocaddy, the biggest selling golf trolley brand in the world. If you've liked what you've been hearing, please do follow us at Filthy Lip Out on Twitter. You can also like, subscribe and share wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you again. Thank you, Michael. Thank you, John. And we will see you again next week.
Hey, oh, sorry. I was just going to say that he says goodbye as well.
Hey, mate, he's well polished.
Okay, guys. Cheers, man.
Thank you, Michael. Legend, man.